This podcast brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Hello, everyone. This is Paul Bertarelli reporting for AvWeb. We're speaking today with James Hayhurst, who recently witnessed a world record skydive by Alan Eustis at New Mexico. And James is with the USPA and was there to verify the record. Have I got that right, Jim?
Absolutely, yep.
Well, tell me a little bit about how you got involved in this jump and what the overriding goal of the event was.
Well, first question, how I got involved. The first time I learned of this was actually during the Red Bull Stratos effort. We were just about, sorry about the background noise, I'm at an airport right now. But in any case, we were just about to do the first manned jump with this Red Bull Stratos project. That would have been in, I think it was in March of 2012. And in February, I got a phone call from a gentleman named Alan Eustis, a USPA member, United States Parachuting Association member, a fairly experienced D-license holding skydiver. And he introduced himself, explained that he was an engineer, had some, he didn't actually get into details about his employer, Google, but he had long involvement in engineering and computers. And so we had a long and wide-ranging conversation about partially about what Red Bull was doing, their attempt to break Joe Kittinger's unofficial world record, but also just about the whole process of going up to high altitude, the dangers of pilot chute entanglement that had killed Russian skydivers, and just all the hazards. And then as the conversation finished up, we both agreed that wouldn't it be wonderful if in fact Felix Baumgartner was to set the new world record, that somehow an American would win it back, because Felix was using the resources of Red Bull, but it was all American. It was American engineering. Sage Cheshire from California, Joe Kittinger was behind it. So it was an all American production with an Austrian doing the jump itself. So the conversation ended on that note, and I pretty much forgot about it as I got wrapped up in as official observer for the Red Bull Stratos project. Actually, one of two official observers. There was another gentleman named Brian Utley, who was a GPS expert. Anyhow, that's where it started, and little did I know, all the time during the Red Bull Stratos project, which extended through 14th of October 2012 with the final successful world record jump, Alan had done further research, decided that he needed a contractor, had approached Paragon Space Development Corporation out in Tucson, and they began a long journey, one that they thought might actually catch up with Felix Baumgartner and the Red Bull Stratos attempt. But as you might expect with the normal engineering issues and safety issues and testing issues, it stretched out on and on and on. And then finally this winter, actually I take it back, maybe this earlier this summer, they said they were getting close. And then about a month ago, they contacted me and said they were about ready to do some live jumps, and could I come out and begin witnessing their efforts? And they've made three manned jumps in the last month, and I was at all three of them.
And were those lower altitude jumps, I assume?
Yes, the first one about 2 weeks ago was 57,000 feet. The second one was 105,000 feet and actually broke Joe Kittinger's now recognize national records for highest exit for a U.S. citizen, longest drogue fall, and highest speed attained in drogue fall, free fall with a stabilizing drogue. But even so, Alan asked me if I would just sit on those record claims because he was going for the big one, which he did yesterday on the 24th of October. So, yeah, there were three successively higher jumps over the last month.
So, and those first three were kept, or first two were kept entirely quiet, I guess.
Absolutely. In fact, the whole effort was not in any sort of sneaky way at all, but they just quietly wanted to go about developing the spacesuit, the environmental pack, the new method of deploying the pilot chute called the Saber system, which keeps the pilot chute or the drogue chute safely away from the jumper. And all of this was under the umbrella of Paragon Space Development Corporation's ongoing scientific efforts to, you know, get a foothold in space. In addition, a spinoff from Paragon that had formed almost at the exact same time with perfect serendipity, it's called Worldview. And the idea is to take up a capsule with possibly 6 passengers on board and float up to 105,000 feet and give those passengers about a 3-hour world view, and then bring them back safely to Earth underneath a parasol or, you know, a winged canopy. And so this dovetailed perfectly into that ongoing effort. You know, it gave them exactly what they needed, a test program to explore all the various scientific issues that were going to have to be addressed. So that was truly a serendipitous occasion that Alan Eustace approached Paragon just as they were developing this worldview concept.
So the testing data that came out of this may inform that project by the sounds of it?
Exactly, yeah. And all that time, and it wasn't, I wouldn't call it a cover story, but all that time that they were doing testing at Roswell, and they did dozens of iron dummy tests and various scientific tests, getting more familiar with ballooning, getting more familiar with all the high-altitude issues, developing the Saber deployment system. All of that was done kind of in plain sight, but people just figured Paragon Space Development Corporation was just doing a bunch of testing, and most people wouldn't have cared, but they didn't realize that this was driving forward towards Alan Eustace's actual manned test. So in a way, it was a perfect cover story, not that it was a cover, but it was a perfect umbrella for the testing that would lead up to the manned jumps to take place. And their team, which was quite small, you know, you probably recall Winston Churchill's quote, two of us can keep a secret if one of us is dead. But that aside, it was such a small group, and it's such a collaborative effort, and everyone adores Alan. He's just a prince of a man. So no one had any motive to spill the beans or go outside their immediate tight circle at Paragon. And I was under a non-disclosure agreement. And, of course, I kept my boss, Ed Scott, briefed on it. Ed is the executive director of the U.S. Parachute Association. So I have to say, though, it was hard to keep my tongue in my mouth and keep it undercover because it was such an exciting prospect.
I bet. Now, what kind of science has come out of this so far?
Well, there's the one thing is that if we're ever going to return humans from low orbit or from a space adventure, and they need to get down to Earth separate from some kind of reentry vehicle, we'll need a way to get them down, and I think this is the way to do it. This drogue system they came up with actually uses like a deployment system that keeps it safely away from the jumper. It's called I won't go into any detail, but it's called the Saber system, and it solves the problem that nearly killed Joe Kittinger and killed the Russians back in the 60s. That was one, actually kind of minor offshoot. One of the big ones is they developed the first commercial spacesuit in history. Its origins are the NASA spacesuit, but it's an independently developed spacesuit that will be available for commercial uses. And then the third one was they developed this survival pack. Basically, they put a capsule, the capsule that Felix Baumgartner jumped with, they put it on his chest. A 200-pound pack with oxygen, with all the environmental controls necessary, carbon scrubbers, communications devices, all of that was in an integral unit that Alan Eustace carried on his chest. And those are some of the scientific developments that will have long-term applications for both the Worldview project and possibly other projects.
Now, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that they evolved what had been a NASA, probably an EVA type suit. They evolved that and evolved a new life support system.
Yes, that's exactly right. That suit has its origins in NASA's space station. You know, it's not the U2 suit that you saw Felix Baumgartner jump, made by David Clark Corporation. This suit, more rightly, has its origins in the NASA EVA suit. But those people that make the NASA EVA suit were on board and they developed this new commercial suit, which has some, you know, different features. But it is an entirely new suit, and it's not owned by NASA. It's owned by Paragon Space Development Corporation. And it's an excellent suit. They really did a fabulous job. It kind of, you know, it looks like the Buzz Lightyear kind of suit with a big bubble.
Yeah.
In fact, Alan wore a helmet and an oxygen mask inside the bubble of the suit, you know, the helmet portion of the suit.
He was pressurizing that suit, obviously, but was he having to pressure breathe, or was he just breathing normally through the mask?
No, with the oxygen mask on his face, he didn't need to pressure breathe at all. And they kept the suit pressurized all the way up and all the way down, even to landing, because with that 200-pound pack on his chest, there was no way he could do a stand-up landing. You know, his gross weight was about 450. So on landing, the plan was for him to sort of surf that environmental pack into the ground. And a couple times he tumbled. And if you watch the video of this landing, we all joked about it, but it was kind of an ungainly ending. But in a pressurized suit, it helps, you know, he's got basically an air pillow, and it helps absorb the impact of the landing.
Yeah, I noticed on the landing, he pitch-poled, I think, a couple of times before coming to rest.
I think of the three-man landings, he only had one where he was able to surf in and not slip. A lot of times he does end up slipping and tumbling. It's an awkward, ungainly landing with, you know, 200 and some odd pounds on your chest. And you know, he never really had optimal headwinds. It was always light winds or even a tailwind. So, it's a safe landing, especially given that he's in a pressurized suit, but it is a little ungainly. But everyone had a sense of humor about it. You know, there was no Felix Baumgartner stand-up landing. But, of course, Felix was in a depressurized David Clark jumpsuit or flight suit.
We should clarify that this was drogue fall, not free fall, with the drogue out to stabilize him. Did he have any control issues?
Well, that was the thing. The one cool scientific conference that they had out in California a year ago was that it didn't matter how good a skydiver you were not going to be able to control yourself in a pressurized suit. And Felix actually, as you know, was in an uncontrolled spin for about a minute and odd second. So as he passed through 100,000 feet, Felix was completely out of control. And that was their takeaway, was you need a drogue. And actually the FAI, or the IPC, the International Parachute Commission, who writes the rules for the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, the FAI in Luzon, about a decade ago, anticipating there might be some new high-altitude jump efforts, they saw that it would be prudent and most reasonable for anybody who was to attempt those records to take the lesson from Joe Kittinger and use a drogue. So they actually, 10 years ago, with a lot of foresight, they actually wrote a set of rules that listed drogue fall as actually what they anticipated would be any record attempt would be a drogue fall high-altitude jump. And so those records have stood there waiting to be filled by the FAI. Of course, Felix did a free fall, an uncontrolled free fall for quite a while there, but nevertheless a free fall. So he claimed not only the highest exit, but the longest free fall. But the other category, the drogue fall, which everyone would agree is the more prudent way to do this, and certainly in the future will be the only way people do it, that remained unclaimed. So when Alan made his jump, he claimed both the absolute highest exit, regardless, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're using a drogue or not at that point. And then the longest drogue fall, which was about 4,000 feet longer than Felix's free fall, and then the highest vertical speed with the drogue, which was just about 20 miles an hour slower than Felix because of the drogue.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I thought that that Eustis was a little faster, but Baumgartner was faster?
Well, Felix, or Alan was faster going through 100,000 feet. If you look at their... I was the official observer for that effort as well. And passing through 100,000 feet, which is right when Alan had his peak velocity, he was going, 622, Mach 1.23. And at that same point in time, Felix Baumgartner was going about 609 miles an hour, and his Mach was, say, 1.19 or 1.20. So at that point, Alan was going faster. But from 100,000 feet to 9,000 feet, Alan began to decelerate. Again, sorry about that background noise. I got a speaker right over my head. So from 100,000 feet down to 91,000 feet, Alan began to decelerate. So his peak velocity was, in fact, at 100,000 feet, whereas Felix continued to accelerate until he hit 91,000 feet. And in that 9,000 foot of acceleration, he picked up 20 more miles an hour. So he ended up at about 640, and Mach 1.24. So a slim increase, but you have to keep in mind that whole time he was completely out of control, whereas Alan had perfect stability.
You heard an audible sonic boom with Eustace?
Yes, absolutely.
Did you feel it?
Yes. Now, when I say it wasn't me who felt it, it was the chase crews. They both were about 50, 60 miles out.
Okay.
So I was in mission control, but the chase crews that were directly underneath the balloon in pickup trucks and on the ground just waiting to see a canopy, in both cases, both Felix's jump and Alan's jump, they both heard sonic booms, and you know the difference in Mach number was 0.01. It was marginal. So yeah, in both cases there was a sonic boom, and both cases the Mach number was nearly identical, with just a 20-mile-an-hour difference in actual velocity.
What did Eustace use for a rig?
He had a United Parachute Technology tandem canopy made by Performance Design. Both companies are based in Florida. So it was basically a tandem canopy, a 350-square-foot tandem canopy, which is big enough to carry a 400-plus payload. And normally it would carry a tandem master and a tandem passenger. In this case, it carried Alan and his environmental pack.
And we should probably explain to listeners that he needed that kind of canopy area for that weight.
Absolutely, yeah.
So where do you think this project goes from here?
Well, I think one main takeaway will be that they have the science now continue forward with the WorldView project, and I believe Paragon Space Development Corporation will be the prime contractor for WorldView, and they have the expertise and the know-how to continue forward with a six-passenger capsule. And the other takeaway is I think Alan Eustace's wife, Kathy, is going to be a whole lot happier woman now that her husband is safely on the ground.
Do you think that if a six-person capsule, they would land in that under some kind of a airfoil, correct?
Exactly, yeah. And that's a big project, because now you're fabricating a capsule, a pressurized capsule, and the intent is a shirt-sleeve environment inside that capsule. So that will task every little bit of Paragon Space Development Corporation's technical know-how. They do a lot of environmental work for NASA already, and they know about capsules and oxygen scrubbers and so forth, but it'll still be a big challenge.
This record's at about 135,000 feet. Is it technically possible, do you think, to exceed that?
Saying that, I don't really see any point in going any higher. I mean, it's an expensive deep pocket proposition for sure, and Alan actually has two more balloons that he could use, but I think he's going to retire and leave it alone and just try to move forward with scientific applications from this point forward.
All right, Jim. Well, I know you got to catch your airplane, so I'll let you go. I appreciate your speaking to our audience.
Okay, my pleasure, and I apologize for the background noise.
No problem.
If it comes with aviation, right?
Yeah. We've been speaking with Jim Hayhurst of the United States Parachute Association, who recently validated Alan Eustace's record jump from 135,000 feet from a balloon in New Mexico.
This podcast brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.